You are listening to Anti-Institutional Extremism, Causes and Responses, a podcast series from the International Center for Counterterrorism. In our third podcast series, we discuss the issue of anti-institutional extremism. This series considers, what is anti-institutional extremism? What does anti-institutional extremism look like in North America and Europe today, and how can it be addressed?
Hello, I'm Dr. Joanna Cook, Editor-in-Chief and Senior Project Manager at the International Center for Counterterrorism. Welcome to the show. It is my pleasure to be your host. Today, we will focus on defining what anti-institutional extremism is and what it is not. We will also consider who is involved in anti-institutional extremism and how it is evolving. But first, I'd like to introduce you to our two guests today. Dr. Barbara Molis is a researcher of current and emerging threats at the International Center for Counterterrorism. An expert on the far right, her work focuses on the online sphere, including disinformation analysis, conspiracy theories, gender-based hatred, and anti-institutional threats. We're also joined by Professor Tore Bjørgo, who is the director of the Center for Research on Extremism at the University of Oslo. He's also an adjunct professor at the Norwegian Police University College. His main fields of research have been right-wing extremism, terrorism, disengagement from violent groups, prevention, and policing. He's recently edited a special issue and special section on anti-government extremism in the online ICT journal Perspectives on Terrorism, which I highly encourage you to read. Welcome both. Tore, let's start with you. What is anti-institutional extremism, and what is it not?
Well, it goes under different names. Some call it anti-institutional extremism, some call it anti-government extremism, but it's more or less the same. The general notion is that it refers to movements or ideas that the government or institutions do not have a legitimate basis for exercising power. But it takes different expressions, and also some of these kind of movements reject government as a matter of principle, whereas others are more kind of issue oriented, but it, to such an extent that they still to accept the legitimacy of institutional decisions. For example, the outcome of elections where their man didn't win, this kind of issues. It may take different expressions. One form is what we can call anti-governmental movements that typically in the past used to be wing anarchists. Today, they are more likely to be from the far right. The second expression is conspiracy theories that undermine the legitimacy of governmental authorities, institutions, policies, and political opponents. A third expression is forms of collective actions like mass violent demonstrations and insurrections. And a fourth type is attacks, plots, threats, and harassment against politicians and government representatives. So these are different expressions, but they are all, and they are to some extent linked in the sense that people who reject the legitimacy of government may are likely to take part in collective action like insurrections. They may hold conspiracy theories, or they may even get involved in violence. So it's often linked together, but at least these are four different expressions.
And with this movement, then, it seems like a very diverse movement. You mentioned anti-government, conspiracy theories, collective action, and then the more direct attacks, plots, and threats. Are we talking about a highly organized movement? Are we talking about a leaderless movement? Or what adheres this movement to its different components?
It's not an organized movement. It's not one movement either. It's a lot of different type of groups or non-groups who come together, sometimes online, sometimes in the physical world. They rarely have, they're not hierarchical because in a way they kind of reject that system. They are in a way kind of anarchistic, but often they are sharing the same ideas that spread typically very rapidly now online. We've seen, for example, how the QAnon conspiracy theory has spread. Even if it started out as a very American movement, it has spread very rapidly within a few years and months to Europe, for example, where it has got a big foothold in Germany, giving them a local twist, often joined up with other local ideas. And so it's very anarchistic in many ways. And it's leaderless in the sense that it's not someone at the top.
This is very distinct from some of the more traditional forms of violent extremism we've seen in the world in the past 20 years or so, which has really been dominated by jihadism and right-wing violent extremism. What would you say makes these movements either comparable or quite distinct from each other, besides this component of leaderless movements?
I don't think it's easy to say that it's a distinct movement, because first of all, the people that come together here tend to come from different ideological backgrounds, although sometimes some of these groups tend to be hijacked or dominated more by one group than the others. But we've seen in demonstrations that you have, let's say, the anti-vaccine demonstrations we've seen in a number of European countries, where it's not clear who is in the lead. You find traditional right-wing extremists and far-right politicians. You find traditional anti-vaccine people. You have leftist activists. You have people who are new age. It's a lot of different people coming together. But sometimes some of these groups take the lead. We've saw that in Germany, for example, when there was an anti-vaccine demonstration outside the parliament building a couple of years ago, brought together a lot of different people from different ideological directions, but Reichsbürger and neo-Nazis took the lead and tried to storm the parliament. And that is typical, that there are some who grab the opportunity to take some kind of lead.
When we look at other movements like jihadist movements or right-wing violent extremists, we know that when individuals join these, they often gain something from that membership, a sense of purpose, a sense of belonging, they're ideologically motivated to join. Can you perhaps clarify, what do individuals gain from joining this particular movement? What are the reasons for anti-institutional extremism today?
I think it's still very mixed because there are so different types of people who get involved. And it's hard to say even if they join a movement because it's so diffuse. You have some who adhere to certain conspiracy theories like the QAnon, for example, which spread very rapidly in the US. Some of these people may take part in a demonstration against vaccines or to storm or to what we saw outside the Capitol in Washington a couple of years ago, after the presidential election, where they tried to stop the inauguration of finalization of the election results, which did not bring their candidate, Donald Trump, back to power. These are people who join sometimes for the pleasure of expressing their views, but also being part of something bigger is probably something that they gain from mentally being part of a bigger whole in a sense. But that is this kind of event, like where it's a physical mass movement, a mass event. Then some others are sitting behind the keyboard, taking part in social media. So and that's probably a somewhat different feeling. Also, these conspiracy theories give a sense of meaning in a confusing situation, time of crisis. We saw during the pandemic how these movements really flourished because it was a time of confusion, a time of uncertainty. People were afraid or they did not trust the government. And then these kind of conspiracy theories, which were shared in the online community, gave a sense of meaning to some of these people. So it's often in times of crisis that such movements will flourish. It's often an expression of a lack of trust in government and authorities.
Let's turn now to Barbara. Tori just mentioned the pandemic as a bit of an impetus for how we've seen this movement evolve today. We know that anti-institutional extremism is not new and it's reached both to the right and to the left. And in your opinion, how has this movement evolved and really why is it evolving today? What is really driving this today?
Yeah, thanks for the question and thanks for having me. I think it's the bigger picture that we need to look at. I mean, the threat landscape in general has changed in the past few years, and COVID-19 only expedited that. So, I mean, we know that anti-establishment movements or anti-institutional movements are not new, and we've mentioned this before. I mean, they've been sovereignist movements in the US for the past 20 years. there were protests and anti-government movements in the 70s. The difference was, though, that back then, as Tori mentioned, they were successfully capitalized by the far left and not by the far right, as it's happened during COVID-19. But what COVID-19 did is it created a general, widespread, global sense that collective agency had been taken away by, supposedly, at least in democratic countries, by elected officials that were supposed to protect that agency and remain in power doing so. So that didn't happen. The sense that, you know, there was not enough information, the livelihood was not guaranteed, that nothing was being done to calm that anxiety that was felt by most of us, that created a sense of commonality that everyone was going through the same thing, and then everyone had the rights to sort of demand that agency back. So when we were talking about, like, well, what's anyone gaining out of joining these movements, I think is also restoring a sense of collective agency. So a lot of experts have spoken about the social contract being broken. That is, you know, we've learned in democratic countries that we allow our governments to remain in power as long as, you know, they protect our freedoms. And we give away some of the freedoms, but just so that our livelihood is safe with them. The moment we feel that that's gone, then we feel that we have the right to stand up against these governments and demand more. So a lot of people felt that that was what needed to be done during COVID-19, because obviously the lockdowns and the many restrictions that were imposed because of a sense of emergency, and because it was an emergency, right? So, and obviously what happened then is that everyone started to look at the threat landscape in a different way. They realized a lot of individuals were not necessarily affiliated with any specific organized groups, and they started talking about a new type of threat, and that was mainly sort of alive online, but had expressions offline, because people were certainly going in the streets protesting and mobilizing. But the way we looked at the clusters online didn't necessarily have a mirror effect in the offline sphere. It was not exactly the same. This is due to what Tori mentioned, which is there's no coherent organization. There's no leaders for the most part. But the difference was that the far right all over the West, and I'm talking about Europe and North America, was trying to sort of take advantage of that movement and appropriate it and say, you know, this is an expression of far-right ideals. Especially in the US, we heard the alt-right say, this is us, this is exactly what we've been saying for years, which is that the democratic governments are not doing enough, that they're using the circumstances, the crisis, to overreach, to constrain our rights. And they did that successfully in many quarters, which is why a lot of experts consider that there's not even, you know, a new category of terrorism or a new threat, but just a new sense of deprivation that's been successfully used by the radical right to push for their own agendas, narratives, and arguments, and to even gain followers.
No, I think you raise a really good point, and you used some very specific language there. Both you and Tori have really echoed this. So you highlighted clusters. We've talked about different movements in reference to what Tori has mentioned before. So if we were to really try and more clearly define and give a clear sense of boundaries around what this movement looks like today, what are some of the kind of key characteristics or features which we could really define? As an academic, we're all academics, we all like those definitions, we like clarity in terms of what we're looking at. And I wonder, in your opinion, what are some of the kind of key features that we can really use to define exactly what this movement looks like? And subsequently, we'll get into that a little bit later, but thinking a little bit more about what that means for how we address or challenge some of these actors, perhaps.
It's one of the challenges here is that it's not always clear what makes such manifestations extremist rather than just legitimate expressions of political dissent. Most of what we see is quite legitimate. It's legitimate to disagree with governmental policies on all kind of issues. It's legitimate to go out in the street to protest, but it's not extremist. It does turn extremist when people incite to violence or take part in violence, where they completely reject to obey any kind of governmental instructions. We have seen this happen with the sovereign citizens movement and the Reichsbürger movement in the United States and Germany, where participants in these movements reject to obey laws, whether it's traffic laws or paying taxes or these kind of things. And when they reject, they often oppose physically and violently, even with guns. And there have been a number of police officers in the United States who have been shot dead after traffic stops, or in Germany, where there were violent and armed opposition when police came to collect illegal guns or evict a person from their house, these kind of things. Or if they plot to carry out a political coup, I mean, that is when it turns really extremist. And then we have these kind of conspiracy theories that completely undermine the legitimacy of any kind of government, saying that the government are lizards from March or wherever, and making up all kind of conspiracy theories that might legitimate armed opposition. Then it gradually turned into extremism. But holding such views as such is not extremist. It's legitimate to hold strange ideas. But when you act on them, then that is when it turns extremist.
Barbara, I might ask you to respond to this and add any other comments you might have in relation to this. But we have just highlighted a couple different components here. We've highlighted both legal protests, legitimate protests, and also illegal components, those illegal activities, breaking the law, conducting violence, inciting violence. But in your opinion, do you think we should view this, I keep referring to it as a movement because I sometimes struggle with exactly how best to describe this, but should we instead view this movement as having a spectrum of support from the individuals who are involved in it?
I mean, you're right in everything you said. And there's no clarity. I mean, I know that we're all looking for clarity based on evidence and case studies, and we're trying our best. But it is important to highlight that there's no consensus right now. I'm referring to the European Union. There's no consensus. Each state has had a different experience with this type of threat. Some states don't even acknowledge the threat or think of it as a new category. Some of them, I mean, I've spoken to security and safety agencies that say, well, you know, all terrorist threats have always been anti-institutional, unless we're talking about state-sponsored terrorism. So this is a characteristic, and it's part of, again, a changing landscape. And the characteristic is new, but it's new for a lot of different threats. I mean, we've seen far-right groups, jihadist extremist groups, and the far-left just adapting to the new post-structural or post-organizational landscape online. We've seen that lone wolf terrorism, it's still the main threat for a lot of countries. And that means that, you know, that this sense of like, I can act on the basis of the different narratives that speak to my own sort of grievances is still the main problem. So we can talk about this being new and a new category of a threat, but it's not something that everyone agrees upon, sadly, because it would make our job as researchers much easier. But yeah, I just wanted to start with that. And obviously, what's complicated now is to try and invest in more research to see if, like, the more evidence we gather, we actually can speak of a threat on its own or not. But you were asking me now about the type of support. If we can talk about a movement, or we can talk about a sort of coherent sense of support among different people. I would say definitely as to what was saying at the beginning, there's no coherent support in the sense that not everyone is there or participating of these narratives and conspiracy theories, endorsing them and going in the streets to protest on the basis of them because they have the same agenda. It's not clear what they want to impose. It's very clear what they're against. I mean, we're talking about democratic governments here or democratic governmental actions, because as we've seen with January 6th, it was not anti-establishment. It was against one particular government. So, you know, different concepts also reflect different case studies. That has to be clear. But yeah, it is, the sense is that there's common ground. So everyone involved in this type of movement, if we want to call it that way, has a sense that, you know, the government in power at that time and the public institutions affiliated with that government have not spoken to their needs as they should. And so they do use similar mechanisms to spread their narratives. For example, that's also some sort of common ground that we found. But again, it's not that different from other threats that we know, and especially if we're talking about the online landscape. So yeah, if we talk about offline, we have seen a lot of, you know, paper terrorism, systematic breaking of the laws, like Toria was saying, including not paying taxes. That's something we've seen as an expression of this type of threat. But they also use social media spread to do-it-yourself type of content and conspiracy theories the same way that the far right would do it, or someone who's a member of a far right organization, or even jihadist extremists would do it. So it's not too different. And I think that's something that we started the conversation saying, right? That, I mean, we see elements and cases where it's very difficult to neatly put expressions of the threat in old categories, especially terrorist categories. But that doesn't mean we know exactly where to put it, right? I mean, for starters, a lot of different states are defining it in completely different ways. So for example, when I speak to the Dutch authorities, they say that, you know, there's no racial component in this new threat, and therefore we can't speak of, we can speak of overlaps with the far right, but we cannot speak of like sort of a new form of the far right. But as I see it, based on the different evidence that I've collected as a researcher at ICCT, a lot of these different expressions of the movement endorse conspiracy theories that at the core have a lot of recycled far-right tropes. And I'm sure or won't disagree with that. I mean, we've seen a lot of anti-Semitism. We've seen a lot of xenophobia, a redefinition of the collective, of the people. Who are the people? Who is the collective that deserves to be protected by the government? And who is the government representing? And that redefinition, which emerged during COVID-19 or strengthened the idea around COVID-19, I mean, we're talking about a period in time where you had democratic government saying, we need to strengthen our borders. We need to limit freedom of movement. So what is the far right going to do? It's going to push for their narratives against immigrants. It's so easy. And it did find ground. I mean, it got stuck in many different countries, and it successfully appeal to a lot of people. So I've seen this xenophobic component repeatedly being expressed across different movements, individuals, or groups that, you know, we call anti-institutional or anti-establishment.
Tori, did you want to respond to that as well or add anything else?
I think what we have seen over time is that the main kind of movement has moved historically from the far left with the left-wing anarchist movement that emerged in Tsarist Russia in around the 1880s onwards, which was clearly a left-wing. That was also a very diverse movement, but part of it clearly a left-wing revolutionary movement that opposed government as a kind of matter of principle. It faded during the 1920s and 30s. Re-emerged during the 70s and 80s to some extent in the left-wing militant movements, survived the anarchist youth movements like Antifa later on, but they were no longer terrorists in the sense. They were militant, but not terrorists. But on the other hand, we also got a right-wing long tradition of this. You had the ideas of the World Zionist conspiracy, the Elders of Zion, which later became a new emergence with the Zionist occupation government, Zog theory, which was very popular during the 80s and 90s in the extreme right with neo-Nazis. Then you got the idea that the Jews had already got in power, they controlled everything. Then you got the idea of the New World Order. These were also far-right ideas. You had the Eurabia theory claiming that there was a secret deal with European leaders and Muslim leaders that the Muslims should invade Europe and take over here. Then we got the Great Replacement Theory, which was also the idea that there was a conspiracy to replace the white population with a foreign ethnic kind of movement. And then you got the QAnon Theory, which emerged in the United States, which had a lot of resonance in Europe. All these were mainly far-right theories. And they have been quite dominant in this movement. So today, or especially in the United States, the far right has always been very skeptical, to say the least, to federal government. So there have been a kind of anti-government modus in the right, even into the Republican Party mainstream. In Europe, the main far-right movements have been, in a way, pro-strong state dictators like Hitler, Mussolini, Franco, and so on. So there was a different tradition. But still, we've seen how this American form of thinking has gradually got a foothold in the far right in Europe, where the far right and the right-wing extremists have become more anti-state, anti-government. And the ideas like QAnon has got a strong foothold in some quite big circles in Europe, sometimes fusing with other ideas, like we see that with the Reichsbürger movement in Germany, which has a very kind of German-specific background. They reject the modern German state. They want to go back to the pre-World War I Reich with Kaiser and monarchy, which is a very different thing. But they've fused that with these ideas ported from the United States, from very strongly inspired by the Sovereign Citizens Movement, for example. So you get these kind of strange hybrid movements, but still has a clear link to the far right.
I'd like to summarize some of the descriptions you've used in relation to this movement here from both of you. We've talked about anti-democracy components. We've talked about anti-government, racist elements, elements that have a history or a link to the far right. I think we also can perhaps speak a bit to an anti-elite or an anti-elitism component as well. And I'd like to finish our podcast here today with two final areas to look at. You've also both used the word threat. So we're talking about different types of threats here. When we look at this grouping of different actors and features today, what is the threat that we're looking at? And after that, I'd like to discuss a little bit about, as researchers, how can we best investigate and research this movement? But Barbara, what is this threat today?
Yeah, good question. Because I mean, after all, what we want to understand is, like, if it's an actual threat and there's, you know, potential for violence, what can we do to prevent it? And one of the reasons why it's also not clear whether we should call this a terrorist threat is because there's been no terrorist attacks per se that have claimed the attack based on anti-institutional or anti-establishment sentiment as we understand it today, I mean, post-COVID-19 era, so to speak. But there is a widespread understanding that the risk of violence emerging from anti-institutional threats is hard to predict due to the threat picture in general being less clear. So I know I'm repeating myself, but the threat landscape is changing and old ideological categories, as we used to call them, are changing as well. So violence is a little bit harder to predict. However, there is a sense that there's an increased likelihood that we will see violence on the basis of this type of sentiments, because there's new levels of susceptibility to extremist ideas. And we've seen this with the normalization of disinformation, and especially disinformation and conspiratorial narratives that put at the center or the focus on the democratic government as a threat, or the elites, as you were mentioning. Regardless of the actual threat of violence, I think it's important to highlight the non-violent long-term effects of this type of sentiment or slash threat. Because these movements, what they do is they damage the trust in democratic structures and values. And that fuels, obviously, distrust that permanently can damage our democracies, essentially. And I think that's the main threat that we should keep in mind, regardless of the level of violence that may happen.
Or, in your opinion, what is this threat today?
Well, I do not quite agree that there hasn't been a kind of terrorist outcome of this. We saw the huge attacks in Oklahoma City in 1995 was inspired by the militia movements and was clearly an anti-government attack.
Sorry, I meant I agree with you, and I meant post-COVID-19. Post-COVID-19 I haven't seen, but yeah, I agree.
Also, we had the attacks in Norway on the 22nd of July 2011, which had a huge car bomb against the government building and then attacked and the massacre against the Labour Party's youth movement. That is also to be considered anti-government attack in a very extreme form. We have had several assassinations of politicians in Germany, in the United Kingdom, which were inspired by these ideas. And we had, of course, the plots by the Reichsbürger movements, so groups inspired by the Reichsbürgers in Germany, at least two plots to carry out coups, including violent attacks. They were detected, and they were not really very realistic plots, we have to say. So there has been quite a lot of violence. What I think is also a big issue is the kind of harassment and threats against politicians and governmental representatives, which has a lot of impact. We have done studies in Norway where we see an increase in serious threats against elected politicians, members of parliaments and government. Now, the last time we did, almost 50%, 46% had experienced serious threats or to themselves, their families, vandalism of property and so on. And there is an increase in the number of Russian politicians who become hesitant to express their views in controversial issues because of this, and they consider to leave politics. So it has an impact, and I think that is a serious threat.
We're all researchers here, and part of what we do in our day-to-day is better try and understand and describe and explain and bring nuance to some of the phenomenon we see in the world around us. And right now, you suggest that we don't really have necessarily a shared understanding, or there's not one definition of anti-institutional extremism today. So the question I pose to both of you, and just for full clarity here, do we as researchers have a shared understanding of anti-institutional extremism? And what are the implications of this for how we as researchers can describe or explain or better contribute to understanding this movement today? Barbara, let's start with you.
Thank you. I think we're all working towards finding that common understanding because it's necessary to inform policies. But I've spoken to a few authorities and they're concerned that they're not understanding the threat the same way among different states because, as I was saying before, they keep in mind different examples. But I mean, there is common ground, and we've discussed here today, from which we could potentially find a definition. But I mean, it's not that we all agree on what terrorism exactly is, and we still are able to cooperate and act against it. So it's not like we have to have a very specific definition that is not going to change. But we can have a working common definition that allows for more cooperation, especially Tori just mentioned the transfer of ideas coming from the US to the EU and shaping our own threat landscape, especially, you know, when it comes to the sovereignist movement. So this transnationality means that this type of threat is active across borders. And that means that we have to sort of like think along the same lines to allow for multi-agency cooperation, to allow for cross-border cooperation for prevention and intervention.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that was part of the purpose special issues we produced on anti-government extremism, to start academic conversation about this, because it's hard to reach a kind of common understanding because the phenomenon is so diffuse. And the expressions experienced in one country differs from how it runs out in another country. So we have to just have a discussion on it and start to do research, look at the different expressions, look at what are the commonalities, what are the differences, and work towards a better understanding. I don't think we'll ever get the final answer with two lines under it, but we are working to understand the different manifestations, the different nuances, try to grasp this phenomenon better. And the term anti-government extremism or anti-institutional extremism is attempts to grasp a very slippery phenomenon. That's the way we kind of conceptualize things, is to try to find a way to discuss it. And the first move is just to find a word, and we don't even agree on the name of it. So that's part of the challenge.
I think that's a great point, Tori. And Barbara, I'm going to turn it to you here for a minute as well. So Tori's just made a suggestion as to how we can better respond as researchers to this. And you've highlighted some excellent points as well. Would either of you have any good practices or areas where the researchers who are probably listening to this podcast or the practitioners working out in the field today who are also listening to this podcast, what are some good practices that we as researchers or practitioners can embrace when we're looking at and trying to respond to this movement today?
As researchers, I think one of the key elements that has been crucial to shape this threat, and maybe this is me, but I think it's been the disinformation, the increase in disinformation since COVID-19. because this is linked to the distrust towards sort of like traditional sources of information. And so I think that more looking at how this information works, what's the nature of this information and what makes certain users to want to diversify the sources without necessarily checking whether what they're looking at, what they're reading is evidence-based, would really help address part of the root causes of this. But again, not as researchers, but beyond that, I think governments need to invest in addressing the root causes and grievances that fuel this threat, especially since COVID-19. And I keep pointing at COVID-19 as sort of a turning point, because that's when we started speaking of sort of a new threat with movements such as the Kurdankan Freedom Party movement, Corona Care Front. I mean, there's so many. Identitarian movement changed to Freiburger, as Tori has mentioned several times. There is a turning point. So we have to look at what happened there for us to, you know, think about the threat in different ways, especially the role of far-right narratives and the far-right in general, like we've pointed in this interview. I would say that we have to learn how to deal with this information first. And then when we know how to do that, it will be also a way to tackle with the spread of conspiracy theories that's been increasingly normalized. And I mean, it's obviously a final point that I wanted to make, obviously very important to keep promoting democratic structures and values, because as I say, this is the long-term sort of consequence that this particular threat will really have an impact on. And I think we need to invest in, as researchers, you know, understand how can we rebuild trust towards established institutions if those are the sources that are, you know, that don't have necessarily a willing audience to speak to anymore. What type of partnerships can we encourage so that that trust is rebuilt on grounds that, you know, people or the wider groups that will be susceptible to this threat think are legitimate.
Yeah, I think they're good points. I think we could add that we should try to explore this diverse phenomenon without creating moral panics here. It's always easy to blow up threat to make it the kind of something that society has to crack down hard on. Most of what we see is legitimate. It's something we have to accept within the framework of liberal democracy, even if these are movements that oppose liberal democracy. We should not sort of undermine our own values by cracking down too hard on it. But we also have to study and to intervene when some group cross over the boundary of violence and terrorism, which parts of this movement has the potential to do, but most of it does not. And we should sort of try to keep this, our approach as academics and as citizens, to have a realistic and muted response to it. We should definitely study it, but we shouldn't, in a kind of academic self-interest, blow it up to more than it deserves.
Thank you so much, Tori and Barbara, for speaking with us today about anti-institutional extremism. In our upcoming episodes, we will look more concretely at what this looks like in Europe and North America and what can be done to counter this. Don't forget to visit Perspectives on Terrorism and ICCT website for recent publications by these same guests, and keep an eye out for Barbara's forthcoming book on Russian influence of right-wing extremism in Europe. And indeed, I can really recommend Perspectives on Terrorism, the special edition that was curated by Tori Bjorgo. Thank you again both, and tune in for our next episode.
This podcast episode was created by the International Center for Counterterrorism and is part of the series Anti-Institutional Extremism, Causes and Responses. You can find more episodes and information about our work on our website www.icct.nl. This show is available on any major podcast service, so please subscribe and spread the word.